Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, I want to let you know that in this episode with comedian Maria Bamford, we talk about when she's contemplated suicide and how she got help when she needed it. If you or someone you love is at risk of suicide, please go to suicidepreventionlifeline.org to find resources and someone to talk to. There's a link in our show notes, too.
My mom said when I played the violin starting when I was 3 years old, and she said, as soon as I got up on stage, I lit up. And and I think that's always been the case for me, that I feel good in front of people. And I think it is the perceived sense of control. Of course, you have no control at all. But the idea that I might, with a microphone and a light bulb on in my face, seemed very attractive to me, and still does.
This is Death, Sex, and Money.
That's life. Sorry.
The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot.
You must pay the rent.
But I can't pay the rent.
And need to talk about more.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you speaking to me or sleeping with someone else?
I'm Anna Sale. Maria Bamford is turning 50 this year. She started doing stand-up back in her early 20s, in public. But she was working on bits much earlier, when she was growing up in Minnesota.
I was a shy kid. My mom and my sister are kind of the bigger personalities in our family. My dad would give me a timed set at dinner time to talk. He would set a timer and I'd get 3 minutes.
That, starting like when, how old were you?
I think maybe 7 or 8. I remember the feeling of like, you got to say something really good right now. Like, you got to say something like killer. Like, okay, there are these, okay, Miss Labadie, fifth grade, she told me about these bodies in Amsterdam that were found beneath the bogs, fully formed human beings with skin on, and they're still there, but they're from the 1400s. That's my time. Thank you very much. Like, it had to be good. Okay, a volcano covered an entire village full of people in there. You can see them running in the ash. Anyways, okay, that's my time. Good night, everybody. It was also, a lot of death. I think I was always sharing some horrible story.
Maria has since made a career out of excavating dark material, a lot of it from her own history with mental illness. She's dealt with intrusive thoughts, mania, depression, and suicidal ideation.
I have done very well with mental health shtick, and I was, but I've been feeling so good the past several years, I don't have any new material about it. And I thought, maybe I should worry about that. But then I remembered that I'm on antipsychotics and it is no longer possible for me to worry.
This is from her new special called Weakness is the Brand. And it turns out there is a bit of mental health shtick and also a lot about money.
I may be mental, but I'm also a millionaire.
You have a line in your new special where you say, I may be mental, but I'm a millionaire.
A millionaire. Yeah.
And what have you found that are your priorities when it comes to how you give your money and how you spend it?
I'm not the greatest person. Like, I spend a lot on clothes and food. Yeah, I definitely, I think we spend around $1,500 to $2,000 a month on food and dining out, which I think is above average.
Is that something, are you a person who like spreadsheets month to month what's happening with your money?
Well, here's the deal. You can't say that you're in 12-step programs publicly because apparently it's a cult. But I've been in those groups for about 30 years. And then one of them I've been in is money-oriented. There are two that are called, there's one called Under Earners Anonymous and one called Debtors Anonymous. And that, part of the sobriety in those programs are to, just be conscious of what you're spending, not in a judgmental way. It's sort of like either, just so that you have some choices.
At what point in your life did you realize that going to a group, a support group around money management was was something you needed to do?
Well, it was part when I didn't have a place to live. I couldn't afford the rent I was in, and I'd hawked everything that I had at the time. So, yeah. So, and I didn't want to ask anybody for money anymore, and I didn't have an answer. And I was in another 12-step program, and they said, hey, there's this other thing that you can get help emotionally about how to figure out how to live.
Maria was 24 at the time, living in L.A. and trying to make it as a comedian. But she struggled to cover rent and food.
Although I had a college degree, I just did not know how to get and keep a full-time job, much less a part-time job. I worked mostly in restaurants, which when I moved to Los Angeles became problematic because people are restaurant professionals. There, you cannot be bad at it and keep the job. And the great things about 12-step groups that I love so much, they can't kick anybody out of 12-step groups. That is one of their rules. So you can go sit there with a bottle of Jack Daniels and a Big Mac and yell out expletives. They'll probably tell you to go to the back of the room, but you don't have to believe in any of this stuff. And the one thing I do believe in is that groups cognitively, scientifically help each other when we get together, and there's a lack of shame. I got the support of how to keep a job, what I might be good at. I ended up getting temping and then getting a full-time secretarial job. How to show up and pay bills. And the one thing, which is so totally common sense, but it's the kind of thing that you need somebody to tell you when you're in a crisis. They said, call everybody you know to try to find a couch to sleep on. And it just didn't even come to mind. So I did that, and I found a place temporarily, and she said I could pay her rent in payments over, because I just had no money. And and obviously, I just want to say I acknowledge that I am was raised a upper middle class white lady with every single benefit. So a silver spoon in my mouth, and somehow still had difficulties figuring it out.
It's interesting to me that part of what you learned in group was just guidance on how to ask for help.
Yeah, no, that was the main thing, because I didn't, even with secretarial jobs, I'd go, so if I don't know how to do it, you just ask. And they're like, yeah. I thought you should intuitively, if you are smart, you should intuitively know how to answer all the calls on a switchboard. Yeah, it bizarre, but that's what I thought. That is what I thought.
Having unsteady work meant Maria was uninsured, which led to about $6,000 in medical debt after an allergic reaction to antibiotics sent her to the hospital. She said that took her about 10 years to pay off. She finally got health insurance through the Screen Actors Guild when she started picking up voiceover work.
I began getting voiceover work because I was working as a secretary at an animation studio. I got my first voiceover job, and
that's how it happened?
Yes,
it wasn't through, like, your agent lining you up?
No, I think it's things mostly happen through proximity of, like, oh, this person's over here. Why don't we give them a shot? Like, I that's what I always tell people, just get near it. Get near whatever you want to be.
What has that meant in terms of your mental health care to have reliable health insurance? What's changed in terms of, like, the kinds of care that you get and what it's like?
It's unbelievable. I mean, it's the only reason I think I would be alive today is that I had no qualms about going to the hospital when I felt a danger of hurting myself right away. You know, like I knew that I had mental health coverage, which through my union, you have to earn to get that is so bizarre. You've got to earn over a certain amount to deserve the mental health coverage. What? I'm extremely grateful. Yeah, the whole thing, I believe I was hospitalized twice under my insurance, and that was around 30 grand a pop. and Glendale Adventist Medical Center. Shout out to the Adventists. Uh-huh. And then I went to the wrong hospital. I went to Las Encinas Hospital, and they did not take my insurance, which was so funny because I was desperate, so I just said, okay, well, I guess I'll just stay. And they said, well, in order to stay, you have to write us a check for $3,000 to cover your 72 hours here, which is so funny just because a sign of mania is spending enormous amount of money impractical reasons. And it just seemed very much on point for the whole situation.
Did you do that?
Yes.
Did you write the check?
I certainly did. Oh, my God. Yeah, just because I was scared and I thought, I don't want a chance me not being willing to go someplace else. So, yeah, it's kind of amazing to get there to the hospital. And then, yeah, so it just felt like, I was kind of, also was a bit out of it, you know, not in my best mental health. So perhaps I would have made a better decision had I felt better. But in retrospect, I do have some great memories of people who came to visit, and my parents came to visit me when I was in the hospital, or my mom did. My dad did not. My dad, I've never talked to him about it, but I have a feeling it was too upsetting. I'm not sure what was going on. My mom has been hospitalized as well for mania, so she was a great visitor. She was very mellow. She's like, well, let's just go sit by the cigarette bucket and page through this Oprah. Is the food any good? Oh, God.
That must have been so comforting to have somebody with you who understood.
Yeah, it was comforting. I mean, I was super mental. I was feeling terrible, so nothing was good. Anything good is only in retrospect. If you've ever had a breakdown or a psychosis or mental, it's not good. It's not good the whole time, and that's why you want to kill yourself, is because it's unbearable. But I'm so grateful that people came to visit me, because you remember that for the rest of your life. I mean, I remember those friends who were able to do that.
How old were you when your mother was hospitalized?
It was around the same time. My mom had a hospitalization probably a year before I did.
Did you visit her?
Well, that is the sad thing. I didn't. I didn't. There's nothing more to be said than that, except that I didn't. And that's, I feel ashamed for that now. I hope that I've changed as a person, because at the time, I wasn't totally doing that great either. But I guess I'll try to have compassion to people who can't make it to the hospital either. It's can be not only inconvenient but also super uncomfortable. And I think I was afraid. My mom in her mania was pretty angry, and it was frightening. So as it can be sometimes, I'm sure I was frightening too. So I'm grateful that people came to visit me when I was frightening.
Maria's hospitalizations were back in 2011. Coming up, Maria talks about the ways she takes care of herself these days, including being disciplined about taking 2 days off a week.
It's funny how hard it is, you know, even as the head of one's own business, to say, I'm going to take the days off. And it's especially ridiculous when it's show business and there are somehow show business emergencies. Like, that is...
Last week, we told you about a new money-related project we're working on, and we asked you to help us out with it by sharing the big financial uncertainties that you're dealing with right now. One listener named Maya sent in a voice memo from the UK about how her budget feels tight, even though she's in a high-paying industry.
There's a lot of pressure because everyone thinks I have a law degree, and that means I'm earning a lot of money. But at the moment, I'm drained financially. I'm drained of energy. And I just have to keep going.
Between paying her bills, finishing up her legal training, and sending money to family members back home, Maya said the stress is getting unbearable.
I'm in two mindsets. The first being, there's nothing you can do. You're working two jobs. You're studying. You're doing everything you can. But the other part, just can't sleep because this lack of control, this constant pressure, phone calls from the bank, it's just getting overwhelming. So I don't know what to do.
We want to hear from you too. Maybe you're a young adult struggling with financial independence, or you're going through a big transition like a job loss, a medical diagnosis, or starting a family. Or maybe you and your partner just can't figure out how to make money work together. Keep sending us your questions about feeling financially stuck. Record a voice memo or send an email to us at debtsexmoney@wnyc.org. On the next episode, I talk with a listener who's getting divorced now about all the ways he rationalized cheating on his wife with sex workers he hired on the internet.
It was a transaction, you know, to a certain extent that, you know, one of my justifications was, you know, I had a therapist, you know, that I went and talked to. I had a massage therapist, you know, and I paid these people, you know, to interact with me in a certain way. The fact that it was transactional made it easier to compartmentalize and say, like, this is cheating, but in a different kind of way.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale.
You have a joke in your latest special about online therapy.
Oh, yeah. Are you an advertiser for BetterHelp.com? Oh, no. I'm so sorry.
I've been paying this one woman online therapy $200 a month. She just texted me,
Christine, of course you're stressed. You just had a baby.
Well, I signed up for it because I thought I'm on the road so much and I have to drive to go see my therapist in LA, who I love, but she's also $175 a pop, which is well-deserved. Everyone deserves to get paid. Get that money. And I thought, oh, I'll do a cost savings. So I signed up and then she texted me, Christine, of course you're stressed. You just had a baby. And
so does that really happen?
No, of course it really happened.
I think when you shout on stage, and it was helpful, I just, because that's so, it's so true. Like it would have been helpful, like therapy we think is so much about getting in our own heads and have somebody like alongside our own heads, but having somebody say, Christine is also stressed out because she has a baby.
Guess what?
Guess what, you selfish hobo. You know, what about Christine and her baby? You know, that's totally, totally true. I mean, and I do believe that going for help, even if you get super shitty help, can be buoying. You just got to keep asking for help, though. Finding help is like is not unlike dating, where you just got to wait for the good match. Or find somebody who's just sort of good, sort of, who's geographically close to you, and takes insurance.
Speaking of dating, I want to ask you about marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, you have noted that before you married your husband, Scott, both of you had a lot of relationships, none of which had lasted tremendously long.
Oh, yeah.
When you first met him, did he seem like somebody that you might spend a long time with?
Well, I had met so many people. I think the thing that was different was me. You know, that I had met lots of people, but I definitely hadn't had that willingness of, like, if somebody's willing to work it out, let's do this. Like that
was the thing that really cemented us together, was both saying, come on! we can succeed
trying.
At this. Yeah, yeah. Mm. Like, because I really connected with him on that experience. I mean, of course, he's a hot, handsome hunk of wonderful love. And
he's right
and
there
person.
In the control room.
And he's
can,
right there in the control
him.
Room. I can see him. So sweet. And he, you know, had experiences where he was okay with not only me being a comedian, which sometimes people have a hard time with for whatever reason. He didn't have any problem with me having any mental health issues. And also, this was after having a breakdown, I felt like, oh, I need to be perfect in some way or be at my best to be in a relationship. And then seeing people who were in the psych ward with me who were married and had loving spouses. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, I don't have to. Don't wait for it. Don't wait for it to be perfect.
So seeing fellow patients helped you shift about what you could expect and deserve.
Yeah, because I think also, I don't know if that's a thing in New York or in the rest of the country, but LA definitely has like, well, when you really get yourself, I mean, you get to your core and you get your core issues done, and then you go to a remote camping yurt in Big Sur, that's kind of when you're going to be ready to like, I mean, it's all these added things that you have to have in place before you're going to be loved, be lovable, and to find out that is not true.
Maria met her husband Scott through online dating in 2013. They married in 2015 when they were both over 40. And Maria's open in her act about how learning how to be in a relationship and dealing with conflict takes some adjusting when you're both bringing a lot of history into it.
So my husband won't speak to his experience, just that he grew up in a big family, Philadelphia. There's no food because somebody was drinking it all. And though he had a place to live, he would oftentimes, for safety, sleep in the woods. 40 years later, we're trying to decide where to put the new TV.
Maria says they've learned the importance of taking a break when a fight really gets going.
There is a point where you've got to stop, take 20 minutes, distract yourself in any way you can, and because otherwise you will say or do something that you regret, that it's kind of like an animal instinct once you get flooded with too much whatever it is, anger, fear, stuff. And that was really helpful to be compassionate to each other to say, okay, let's stop. Right now, and you know, I'll go in this room. I mean, it didn't happen cleanly at all. Like, I'm not. It was very messy, but I'm proud. You know, we've done a lot of work to become better at having conflict. That it's okay to have conflict.
What was messy about like calling the timeout?
Because there's so many feelings involved with it. Like, my go-to in how I grew up or my way of managing emotions would be to, I'd get overwhelmed and I'd go and contemplate my own death. I've done that since I was eight years old. So that's my go-to. I like to isolate myself and then go weep uncontrollably into a cracked mirror and think about how I'm a terrible person and nobody loves me and I want to die. So that could be disturbing for someone to watch who's in a fight with you. Scott has his own way of dealing with things. He goes on a long walk sometimes, and which at first he wouldn't tell me where he was going, which of course that's the purpose of the walk, is to get away from the person.
But then you're worrying or feeling abandoned.
Then you're
or something.
Worrying. I mean, yeah. It's just and also it's the same thing. What am I doing? Like, Marie, you can't go contemplating your own suicide. What are you doing? Like, you can't. These are not ways to handle conflict. So, I think we've both learned to try things a little differently, like having that heartbeat of a second to go, okay, this is the thought that I'm having. Do I really need to go into this weeping uncontrollably? Like, could I do something slightly different than what I'd usually do? That has given, I think, us both some space to do things differently. I think that's the thing I found really shameful, that it was harder for me to talk about, was like that we weren't having attractive fights, you know, like, or something where it's like, you could see that on a sitcom. Well, you do this. Well, you do that. Boo. You know, and it's like, that was part of the reason I think I probably didn't have any long-term intimate relationships, because once feelings get out of control, I didn't know how to manage them. I think my husband had a very different but similar experience of like not knowing what to do once things get to a certain point. The both of us are our main solution was, oh, you just leave. You just leave.
Yeah, that's interesting to me, because in my arguments in my marriage, it's the like stopping the arguing, because we're both like trying to convince the other one that would be really hard with the timeout.
Yeah.
But it sounds like for you all, the like coming back together after you take a break.
Yeah, and some things aren't ever going to be solved. Like at least that's... I know that's true in friendships. I know that's true in my family relationships. Also, the romantic of like, if it's meant to be, you should never, you know, like, or it's always supposed to feel good. And I've never had that, not only in any romantic relationship, but definitely with friendships and family. Like, I've never felt like, you know, me and my sister were meant to be. My sister drives me bananas, though I love her dearly. Like, you know, like that's always happened. It's going to keep happening. There are issues that will never be solved.
That's comedian Maria Bamford. Her new special is called Weakness is the Brand. It's streaming a lot of places, including Amazon, iTunes, and Google Play. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. I'm based at the studios of the investigative podcast Reveal in Emeryville, California. Our team includes Katie Bishop, Annabelle Bacon, Afi Yellowduke, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. Our intern is Ayo Osubamiro. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. And thanks to Will Quintel in Alaska, who is a sustaining member of Death, Sex, and Money. Join Will and support what we do here by going to deathsexmoney.org/donate. I'm on Twitter at Anna Sale. The show is at Death, Sex, Money on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Maria told me one of her favorite go-to marriage advice sources are the Gottmans, two husband and wife psychologists. We've linked to a classic This American Life episode about them in our show notes. Part of what the Gottmans warn about, as Maria knows, are the four horsemen of relationship communication.
It's a criticism. You, that's a stupid sailboat. Contempt, you and your fucking sailboats. Defensiveness. What? What sailboat? And stonewalling. I'm never going to talk about sailboats with you again.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.